This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. Today, I'm excited to have Professor Anna Kornbluh with me to discuss her recent book, Immediacy with a Style of Too Late Capitalism, published with Verso just a few weeks ago. Anna Kornbluh is professor of English and a member of the United Faculty Bargaining Team at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Her research focuses on cultural production, including the novel and cinema, through and alongside Marxism, psychoanalysis, formalism, and literary theory. Welcome, Anna, and thanks for joining me tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
So maybe to get started, I'll just ask about the genesis of this project. How did this book come to be? And what do the terms in the title mean sort of broadly? So what is immediacy and what is too late capitalism?
Great, totally. So the book came to be with me noticing some things that started to feel like patterns or connections that were possible across both how artworks and literature and cinema and also especially original streaming video were being produced, and then the kind of conversations about how they were being received and consumed and what was expected of them or what was no longer expected of them. So just sort of trying to sort of find everywhere that there seemed to be, or noticing everywhere there seemed to be, this kind of just like intolerance for art and impatience with the thicknesses of representation, and a lot of kind of both well-intentioned and extremely torqued and strange kind of demand that there just be this rapidity and this expressivity and this kind of sheerness to a lot of different kinds of media. So I was sort of noticing that, and I was trying to figure out like what is going on, and can there be a name for this kind of reactive formation and also this kind of production crisis? And in the tradition that I work in, which is the generally the kind of Marxist interpretation of culture, we do try to understand large-scale formations or large-scale rubrics of meaning or styles as related to economic transformations or economic processes. So one of the most famous and illuminating arguments that does that kind of articulation of, as it were, the base and the superstructure in the last 50 years is Frederick Jameson's Postmodernism or The Logic of Late Capitalism. There seems to be a consensus critically that we're not in postmodernism any longer. Jameson himself even says that. So a little bit of the book is, originating and trying to figure out what are we in if it's not postmodernism anymore, and what would be some of the things about postmodernism that would still be with us, but are we enough different from it that we could say there's something else going on here stylistically? And then the too late capitalism is a little bit of like a joke of, how can we exaggerate reiterate or intensify or sort of like think differently about this phrase late capitalism that's been being used for over 100 years to kind of describe the latest in capitalism lately, but also some sense of decline or some sense of possible terminality. And one of the things that I think is very irrefutable about the kind of setup for the argument is that things are different economically now than they were than when Jameson wrote the book. And that specifically what's different is that the kind of crisis of overcapacity and the crisis of underproductivity in the G7 economies that was, you know, partly ushered in and partly symptomatized by deindustrialization and the end of Bretton Woods and various kinds of multinational trade agreements and so on, that really looks different. And it sort of like articulates itself in culture differently 50 years on, when that period of crisis and stagnation has just, you know, protracted. And now it looks like post-war prosperity was the exception rather than the thing that we would get back to in the 90s or the thing that we would get back to after that we got over the financial crisis. So those are some of the terms there that I'm trying to use. And then style is sort of like my effort to name something that's a little bit different than a logic, but is this kind of like art that is pretending it's not art, that is this kind of, there's an anti-style kind of fascination with expressivity, authenticity, you know, realness, a kind of just lust for the here and the now and presence and intensity in the moment. And I wanted all of that kind of energy to be understood as a style rather than as the casting off of style, which is what it kind of presents itself as.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really liked about, I was really interested in reading this book because in a way I feel like so many of the examples, and the book is really incredible for the number of different, for anyone who picks it up, they'll be just blown away by the number of different things that you touch on and that I assume that you've consumed pretty deeply. And I know we've talked in the past about film and art and TV and your very, very deep knowledge of all of these fields. But so many of the examples I really loved reading about because they're examples that I had some kind of relationship to. You know, I've read a lot of the novels that you talk about in the writing chapter. You know, I've seen the TV shows that you mentioned. And some of them I really loved, you know. Right. Others not so much. And so it was really interesting to see the way the category of the immediacy, you know, of immediacy sort of cut across all these different fields and genres and domains. And yeah, I'm really interested by this, the way you're describing the sort of renunciation or repression of style as its own kind of style. So yeah, I'm wondering if you could say more about, I guess, how you think these economic transformations that you mentioned specifically tie into or become sort of determining, I guess, causal forces in this cultural production that passes itself off as, I guess, sort of being unproduced, unstylized, and just being, sort of like pure this year nowness.
Totally. So, you know, the idea would be basically that how capital has responded to this kind of productivity crisis has been intensifying circulation, the kind of other side of the circuit of valorization. So you can make things and you can exchange them. And both of those are sites of value, right? And if you have a kind of lack of productivity going on, you can put pressure on exchanging. So one of the things I try to spell out in the book is sort of like why we're in an intensive phase of circulation and how other kinds of economists and historians have understood previous intensive phases of circulation. So for us in the 21st century, what does that look like? It looks like Postmates, right? You want it, we get it. It looks like rapidity. It looks like instant access. It looks like on demand. It looks like the kind of, you know, Uber effect, you know, that meme, like Uber, but for, right? That we have a kind of process of trying to algorithmically organically connect consumers with laborers that is predicated upon a lot of cutting out of something like the brick and mortar store, or the middle management company, or the taxi firm, or the intervening middleman, right? And so in business lingo, they call this cutting out of the middleman and this, like, you know, enthusiasm for direct contact and for fluid relations and flexible labor and so on, disintermediation. So I was thinking about all of those kinds of economic processes as partially providing an explanation for this rejection of representation, this rejection of mediation, cutting out the middle, getting down to the nub, getting to the point, you know, cut to the Chevy Chase, right? Is like this kind of aesthetic imperative that it seems like a lot of our cultural producers and, again, cultural consumers are working with in the 21st century. And that seems to me to just hew very closely to what is going on in a majority in a lot of our economic processes. What is a problem and what is behind your question in a way, I think, is like, so how is it that the art so directly affects the economic base or so on? And because you historically Marxist aesthetics would understand art forms as taking some distance from the economic base, helping us to understand them, you know, like representing them in ways that we can, you know, kind of critically step outside of them, we can make sense of them. And also that art is trying to like operate different values than what is at the base, right? That art is useless and we have a culture that fetishizes use or so on, right? Or an economy that fetishizes use. One of the kind of worries that I have about this style is that it's just collapsing that distance because it's so invested in things like intimacy and flow and instant transfer and DMs and, like, you know, make no mistake, because I told you clearly what my position is in my artwork, right? And you don't need context to interpret it because you can just have your feelings about it. And like, and it's giving you a direct message that, that kind of cancellation of distance or abrogation of distance is, you know, resulting in this kind of diminished critical capacity for a lot of these artworks. So they're sort of hewing too close to the base. And immediacy is also that. It is that proximity, that over proximity, that lack of intervening distance or middle ground.
Yeah, that's really helpful to think about this sort of difference between the way you're describing like a previous sort of Marxist or materialist understanding of artwork as, you know, famously, yeah, sort of creating some kind of distance between the work and the viewer that allows them to see. You know, I mean, critical artwork allows them to see something maybe they hadn't noticed before. And in this case, now we're seeing artworks that are operating this sort of same economic logic of, yeah, cutting out all these intermediaries and just sort of or at least the artists think they're doing, presenting you with things simply as they are, you know, again, unstylized, unrepresented, right. Unmediated. One thing I was really struck by, I think this comes out most in the chapter on writing, so which deals with contemporary novels and auto fiction and the rise of the memoir, is the way you relate this sort of trend or this change to also other sort of economic, not just sort of these economic transformations you mentioned here, but to other, the way those, I guess, have trickled down to affect the university and other forms of things. So we see the rise of, I'm thinking like of someone like Maggie Nelson, right, who writes this sort of memoir, but it's fiction, but it's also sort of philosophy kind of in theory, and all of these sort of different things all at once. And you sort of relating that to these, to changes in the structure, for example, of universities and of disciplines. And so I'm wondering how you see that, that being sort of another, I guess, sort of causal force in the economic matrix that's then having repercussions in the aesthetic field or something like that.
Totally. That's a great question. So, you know, we can talk about like, oh, the G7 and like the Kilman measure of declining rate of profit or these kind of things, but like, how do people like experience economic relations and how do cultural producers and cultural consumers and cultural critics experience them? It's often through institutions, but our institutions are themselves also in decline and under assault, largely because private equity is taking them over and strip mining them, right? But for, you know, in the case case of the university, what we know is that we have it precisely in this period of stagnation, you know, massive defunding, both federally and state level of higher education on the whole. And so that transmutes into student debt as a crisis, right? That transmutes into casualization of academic labor as a crisis. And that transmutes into things like interdisciplinary innovation, which has some real benefits, obviously, you know, epistemologically, methodologically, and so on. Creatively, the system of the disciplines is old and maybe it's outmoded, right? You know, there is a history to that organization of knowledge, and maybe we're in a different period. But when interdisciplinarity also coincides with like flexible labor demands, right? Optimization, like I can teach anything. I have to teach anything. I can teach at six different campuses and be an intellectual migrant laborer, you know, moving all around, jack of all trades, because I'll do anything that anybody needs me to do. That's not a way to live. It's not, you know, like literally it's poverty wages. It's not a way to have time for processing and producing new knowledge at a, you know, at a meaningful scale in terms of like research and deliberation and writing. And the, you know, this has analog in the publishing industry, both, you know, what we might think of as a literary publishing industry or, you know, books. and it also has one in journalism and in media. So that we have things like, and I'm drawing upon other people's arguments here, you know, the rise of the personal essay as a dominant genre for the 21st century is like pretty strictly correlated to the assault on newsrooms, the firing of editors, the firing of journalists, rise of internet content, the need for new content every day so that there are new impressions on the content because the model is not subscriber anymore. It's revenue-based and ad impressions, you know, in front of people's eyes. And what is personal essay but somehow just the limitless, you know, tap that comes out of your belly button that doesn't require deep background, that doesn't require fact-checking, that doesn't require a newsroom, right, to produce. And then has the added, like, you know, frisson of like, you know, exposure and realness and authenticity and experience and stuff, right? So I'm just trying to sort of schematize that these processes of cutting out institutions or dismantling them, you know, then have these effects on content, whether content is what's at the Huffington Post website, whether, you know, and that it's there instead of in a regional newspaper, you know, whether content is what you're learning in a college classroom from an instructor who has terrible working conditions, whether content is what people who don't have terrible working conditions feel that they can ecstatically celebrate as their like omni-genre, you know, like you can't pin me down freedom, right? And some of that is, again, legitimate and aesthetically and epistemologically meaningful. And some of it is a kind of slurry that is produced by these crushing conditions.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That's super helpful. I have so many things. I mean, I had ideas for what I wanted to talk about, and then now so many things are popping into my head as you're talking. And I feel like as I'm listening to you, you know, I'm understanding the book in so much better than when I read it.
That's my fault then.
No, it's probably because I read too many autofiction novels and have been and this is the first time in a little while that I've spent a lot of time with the theory book, you know, in a way, because, you know, a lot of the argument you were laying out really spoke to me. I mean, these are things that I've experienced, you know. I mean, I was someone who went an academic route and then who was kind of like, oh, why don't I start to become one of these jack of all trades people, which led to working, you know, in art and museums. And, you know, and so like, I totally, you know, have, you know, I, and I see, you know, and here we are making a podcast, right? I mean,
right.
We're doing it, you know, this is it.
We're doing it. Like, we're branding, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to keep hustling. So like,
yeah,
it's great.
Yeah.
And I've got to keep hustling. And
totally.
I mean, less so than you, but.
Right. But no, that's all. Yeah. So there's so many things. One thing I wanted to touch on that I felt like I understood now in our conversation better than when I read, nothing to do with the presentation, but just something that occurred to me, is the way psychoanalysis fits into this all. So I know that's a big, sort of methodologically a big part of how you work, but it seems like psychoanalysis also fits in here, this description you have of, you know, this sort of economic process of cutting out the middleman. We see how that ravages institutions and then has effects on culture. There's also a psychoanalytic dimension that is now much clearer to me, which is this idea that perhaps now we can finally get closer to the objects or things of our desire, if only we can cut out all the mediations or something. And now finally we have, you know, desire itself or something. So I'm wondering if you could say a bit about where psychoanalysis fits into this particular project.
Sure. So I have a long time interest in what psychoanalysis theoretically clarifies and illuminates. And for me, some of that has to do with its affinities with what Marxist theory clarifies and illuminates, because they're both dialectical modes of thought and dialectical modes of explanation. And so I've written about or with or thought with or, and teach all the time psychoanalysis for a very, very, very long time. It was apparent to me in my trying to be a critic who works on aesthetic representations that some of this intolerance that I was talking about, or some of this negation of mediation that I was trying to sort of think through, had psychic manifestations, it had psychic consequences, and it may be issues from psychic spaces. You know, I'm not like a clinician, right? But I do try to provide a little bit of vocabulary drawing on the psychoanalytic tradition of understanding, at least in a Freudian and Lacanian vein, that our psychic symptoms have social determinations and you know, that the social link is what kind of activates our contingent experiences of desire, so that there's something objective and intrinsically objective about desire within the psychoanalytic frameworks that I work in. So what is objective or what is socially determined about the epidemic of anxiety and depression that we're living in? What is objective or socially determined about the kind of impatience that people have with representation, with mediation? And we have a pretty prevalent hypothesis right now from like neuroscientists and sociologists and so on, that we're living in a narcissism epidemic, and like that iPhones did it to people or whatever, that social media made everybody, you know, just selfish. And I think that's a really poor explanation of a lot of the psychosocial dynamics and the just incredible misery that we're living in, right? Declining life expectancy, just massive use of psychotropic and psychopharmacological, you know, treatments for massive suffering. And what is a better explanation, you know, than that people are just morally degenerate? So I wanted to sort of look out to our kind of media ecology, but not in the blameful way exactly, because to me, those industries and their rise really belong to, again, this like attenuation of production in a lot of ways. And the digital revolution has tried to kind of cover over for this attenuated production, but hasn't really succeeded in doing that. And then look also to this like attack on institutions and to this kind of like, you know, human capital ideology that everybody is just going to manifest, you know, hashtag manifest is now like a big, you know, psychological trend. And that's like an incredible amount of pressure on people, right? So I'm just trying to sort of acknowledge that I think there's a really profound experiential and affective dimension to the style that both kind of fuels the longing for it, right? If we're kind of sheared down to like excruciating feeling, if we're kind of trapped in reverberating depression and so on, that we might want art that looks like that or art that engenders that because it's kind of confirmatory, affirmative, mirroring and so on. But we But I think it's suffering. I don't think it's, you know, quite a position of psychic strength. So what I try to sort of suggest in the chapter that's called imaginary, which is a psychoanalytic term, is to try to think about, are we, if we're in a circulation intense time, if we're in an expressive and instantaneous time, does that also not kind of correspond to a kind of inflation of the domain of the imaginary within the psyche, as against what would be called the domain of the symbolic? So that we have kind of a reign of images and identities and kind of dyadic relation, or dyadic kind of mirroring, almost non-relation, as opposed to one of kind of commonly held alteritas, you know, thicknesses, and common language and maybe norms and maybe, you know, kind of room for opacity. And so I am trying to provide a certain form of psychoanalytic description of what I think people are living through, but trying to do that with what I think of as a lot more context than the narcissism hypothesis.
Maybe we can shift gears a little bit. I think I have a way to combine a couple of different thoughts into one sort of question, which was the chapter that spoke to me the most was the one anti-theory. As someone who had a background training in philosophy, you know, I was very in full agreement with the presentation of this sort of philosophical theoretical turn towards a kind of new phenomenology or something. Sometimes in my head, I have this dream of writing an article that would be similar. I would call it like the new Cartesianism or something, right? This idea that, my mental states and my experience are self-intimating, they're self-transparent, and I have immediate access to them. And that I think is that's the premise, I think, of so much of the discourse that you wrote about. But I'm wondering if, on the one hand, there's a part of me that was, you know, totally taken with this idea of immediacy as like this really is the kind of master concept for making sense of so much of cultural production. On the other hand, there's a part of me that wondered if, immediacy, I guess, to put it sort of bluntly, is an illusion. Mm-hmm. And I would maybe even go so far as to call it its ideology. All of the thinkers and artists and writers that you mention, on the one hand, I think you're totally right. I mean, they do, and you quote them. I mean, I love My Struggle. I think he's a fantastic writer. I'm a huge fan. Mm-hmm. When he says, I'm writing, you know, this book about myself and I detest fiction and it makes me sick and all these things, I guess I just think he's wrong, you know? Yeah. And so for me, it's in a way, it's sort of like just classical ideology. He's simply mispresenting and mistaken about what it is that he thinks and what it is that he does. He thinks he's presenting immediacy, unstylized, you know, non-fictional self-presentation, self-unfolding, but it's just completely incorrect. I mean, and it mm-hmm. seems totally fine to me if we, you know, allow for if we're not Cartesians and we allow for the fact that people can be wrong about their own mental states and about their own presentation. So he just simply mischaracterizes his own art. So I'm curious if the category of ideology means anything to you for this project. And yeah, if it's fair to say that immediacy is a kind of ideology, or maybe there's something that Derrida would call a phantasm. It's the phantasm of immediacy, but it always belies a complex series of mediations.
Yeah. First of all, you should absolutely write that article or that book. I think that's really powerful and really explains a lot. So here's the bind. It's definitely the case that Knausgård can be doing something really, really interesting and also be wrong about what he says that he's doing. And it's also the case that these objects, many of which people truly love for all kinds of reasons, I'm not hating on them. I'm trying to explain them, right? I'm trying to put them into relation to other kinds of things that it might not seem like they have much in common with. But to me, I can actually get a greater sense of their texture by thinking about what does Knausgård have to do with Abramovich? What do they both have to do with Toyotaization, right? And so it is definitely the case that, to my mind, there's something that is wrong here. But One of the things that is really sticky and tricky about immediacy is that you're kind of in advance foreclosed from making the argument that this is a mistake or incorrect or ideological, because the valorization of experience and authenticity and realness and individuation and the kind of atomization of experience, like the just preciousness of like, this is me, it's not you, I can't relate to, you know, there is nothing social, right? As all of these writers say again and again, and artists sort of too, like we can only have this intensity of like listening to one another's voices or like vibrating, you know, corporealities, but like that there's non-relation, you know, that is itself a constant foreclosure of inoculation against and so on argument. So you can't tell somebody that their experience is wrong, right? And when they are so threadbarely, you know, vulnerably presenting to you, like, here's how I masturbate while I have cancer, you know, like that this is, that it's not really, it's kind of not possible to make the critical cut that like, this is incorrect. And I think that's part of why I wasn't so interested in using the word ideology that often in the book. I'm definitely talking about a cultural formation in relation to an economic base in ways that the traditions that I work in would suggest is ideological. But there's something about both the kind of whole process through post-ideology and the whole way that, again, the inflation, the imaginary and decline of the symbolic kind of means that there's a attenuating of the meaning frames that would go with ideology. People are not cynical. They believe their own, they speak their own truths and so on, right? It just makes it seem almost like ideology isn't kind of sufficient to describe the weirdness of this absolute rejection of mediation. So I fall back on style, you know, as a word there. And also, I definitely do nonetheless, you know, try to posit that other things are possible, right? So there are residual styles, there are emergent styles, there are good theoretical texts, there are good aesthetic texts, there are things that are committed still to dimension and meaning and requiring interpretation and slowness and all kinds of those values, and impersonality. So I do try to point out these alternative pathways across a lot of the chapters. And certainly, you know, my sense would be that the book itself is supposed to be an alternative pathway for theory compared to these kind of, you know, really profound dissimulations of the theoretical project. But is that a satisfying answer? I mean, it is a hard question. Why is it not just a book about ideology? Why doesn't it just say the ideology of immediacy? But I think it's like, you're kind of preempted from doing that by its own rhetoric.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yeah, no, that's a really helpful way to think about it, which I didn't consider, which is, yeah, right. I mean, that's the I guess the most fascinating part about, if you still want to use that term, that the current form of ideology, which is that it's sort of so dug in that it's completely unable to hear the possibility. It's unable to account, like, to imagine this possibility that one's own forms of self-representation or self-expression or self-perception could be mediated, could be incorrectly understood, that one might not be master of one's own domain, which I think, you know, are the great lessons of Marxism and psychoanalysis, right? That consciousness isn't explanatory. It's something to be explained by, you know, by something else.
Right.
And
just think about that problem. Like, it's not that people are just dupes, that they think that they're their own masters. That is the economic message of neoliberalism. It is the economic message of deindustrialization. It is the economic message of influencer society, right? You do you, because that's your only way to make a living. Hustle, hustle, express, emanate, manifest, manifest, hashtag manifest, right? So we're getting these, you know, there are forces that are giving us these, training us in this approach to the apparency of the self as opposed to the opacity of the self.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's really helpful for making sense of this. Because, yeah, I mean, you could imagine a different form the book would take, where you would take these examples of autofiction or socially engaged art or something, and you could, I guess I could imagine a sort of more classically, if you want to call it that, Marxist form that would say, look, here are these people who think that immediacy is a thing, that they're really experiencing it. But look, we can show you that there's sort of infinite mediations or something beneath it. I mean, I'm curious, I guess, your relationship to that sort of way of thinking. And maybe we could take the example that you have of Edward Bertinsky's work. So who's a photographer who photographs, takes these sort of extreme aerial photographs of like meat production plants and all kinds of like highly industrialized food processing and other like industrial practices that destroy the environment. But seen from his perspective, they're highly abstract, they're very beautiful. And then it turns out you're looking at like the blood from, you know, animal slaughters or something at like a factory farm or something. And that I think you could read as, right, I mean, here's someone who's both like, you know, again, showing you this sort of like abstract, also very beautiful image, but then it also has this critical message of this is what you don't see. This is what you don't know about, right? It does sort of maybe still have this classical side of you might think that the, you know, meat at the supermarket just magically appears there, but actually like this is the secret infrastructure of mediations that doesn't appear due to all of, yeah, the complexity of the global economy or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think his works are so, so interesting, partly to me because even though he's obviously successful, critics really don't like him, and they don't like him because of this abstraction. They don't like him because there's never any people in the photographs. They're impersonal, right? They don't like them because they do that work of disclosure, and there's something grandiose about that gesture of revealing, and we have a post-critical attitude. And I think that they're just incredibly arresting. They're trying to deliver a different kind of perspective, and they have to construct it very, you know, at great expense and with great time and difficulty, things that aren't available to us in the phenomenal body. Like, even if you're a person who works in one of those factories, you don't see it the way that he renders it, right? And certainly if you're a person who's just consuming the chicken breast, you know, at Whole Foods or whatever, you don't see it that way. And so what's the interrelation there of, you know, a job for art of distance, abstraction, impersonality, scale, right? Of defamiliarization and estrangement. And as you say, they're incredibly beautiful too. And then what's the job for criticism of trying to, you know, and it's certainly the job for critique of trying to estrange people from what seems like it's just the way things are, right? It is what it is, is the mantra of immediacy. But in fact, there's a whole set of, you know, really contingent social, historical, and economic choices that are putting us in these conditions. And it's becoming very urgent that we choose differently. So I think the job of good art and the job of criticism and critique is to, you know, reveal those contradictions to, and I think distance has to be an abstraction, has to be a kind of faculty of that, a possible, you know, a tool for that. But we have a lot of theoretical rejection of abstraction, you know, a lot of kind of conviction that there's something unethical about big ideas or about remove.
Yeah, one thing I really loved about the book was it's sort of like the audacity to propose a master concept. I thought that's fantastic. I mean, you know, like I said, my background is in philosophy and having sort of been trained, you know, in this sort of time where I was watching these, you know, certain philosophical and theoretical trends emerge, you know, the sort of new phenomenologies, anti-criticality or something, all these things we've been talking about, you know, I was always, I guess sort of took me time to realize that, like, I actually think the domain of philosophy and critical theory is precisely what you do, right? It's big concepts. It's thinking abstractly, right? It's not shying away from at least being willing to like throw lots of seemingly disparate things under one umbrella, like even if just as a thought experiment, right? You don't have to necessarily, it doesn't have to be compelling, right? But just to be open to pursuing any line of reasoning if the reasoning is sound. This is something I tell students all the time. When you read philosophy, it's right, it's if you're just picking and choosing the outcome of the argument, you're doing it the wrong way. It's about finding good arguments and learning to, you know, if the consequences are strange, then we have to work on the argument, but not, you know, you can't just fast forward to the end or something. But I was wondering if you could say a bit how you, so for anyone who reads the book, I mean, at the end, there's a very passionate defense of writers and artists who are using these much more sort of mediated styles and distancing, abstraction, these other techniques that the book is sort of writing in defense of. I was wondering if you can explain a bit how you understand abstraction. And mm-hmm. This is a slightly critical question, but in the Hegelian sort of Marxist tradition, abstraction is actually identified with I guess maybe the things you see in the earlier chapters, right? Abstraction is the immediate. Mm-hmm. But this is Hegel. The immediate is precisely the most abstract and the most empty. And as Marx says, concreteness is elaborating the mediations conceptually. So I'm wondering how you understand abstraction and concreteness and how it functions in your argument here.
That's an amazing question. Yeah. So I think that the first thing I want to say just in response to the prelude to your question is that, you know, I'm glad that you think that it is a philosophical enterprise. I also think that it's a historical one in the sense that I am trying to think about a little bit the context for these neo-phenomenologies and these neo-realisms and speculative materialisms and so on, that like thought doesn't happen in a vacuum. That's the number one Marxist insight, right? Which is its own kind of abstraction. It's like a form of attending to what are the concrete relations and concrete determinations of thought, but it's also stepping outside of the thought that is doing that, you know, the German ideology, as it were, in order to say, like, no, there's another path for philosophy. There's another path for theory. There's another path for critique, right? That it is that in that attention to how our ideas might be overdetermined by the ruling classes, say, or by the economic conditions of work in the university, say, that you are opening a vista to something else, right? You are doing a kind of thought which steps away from those determinations. So I do think that it's 100% correct that the abstract and the concrete can't be held in simple opposition in both Hegel and in Marx, partly because what is reification but a kind of disgusting concretude facilitated by abstraction, right? Or, you know, a kind of regime of abstraction, that is the capital valorization, right? Which, you know, manifests in the, you know, kind of bizarre concretudes, right? Things that seem like they're not in relation, things that seem like they are their bearers of value in and of themselves and so on. So I think that you have to be always like moving back and forth, juggling dialectically, what is abstract, what is concrete. So all that being said, I do feel that abstraction has gotten a really bad rap in the late 20th and the early 21st century. And this touches on arguments that I make more clearly in my preceding book, The Order of Forms. But I think that we've had this just, you know, kind of overcorrection against big philosophy and against grand ideas and against critique and against the kind of wild ambitions of thought to depart from its circumstances. I mean, Marx never could have written anything if he was himself a German ideologist, you know, or if he could only think in the terms determined by the relations that he elaborated. So abstraction is that, just moving away from those conditions to try to, you know, get some other aperture. And abstractions do also liberate. They do also capacitate. They do open things up. They're not just misrepresentations or bad mediations or, you know, false, specious distance. And they're certainly not just for boys.
That's a great answer. Maybe the final thing we could end on is, since, yeah, the, like I said before, the book, you know, covers so much different territory in such a short span. Maybe for listeners, if you could tell us some culture that you're consuming right now that you're excited about, TV, critical theory, philosophy, art, whatever it might be, just so people can hear a little bit about like these other, because the book mentions, you know, some artists and writers that you think are sort of showing this other path. But curious, like, what is Anna Kornblue consuming right now that you think is, yeah, that would have been mentioned in if you were to rewrite the book right now, like those who would be mentioned at the end as like, these are the figures to look to.
Oh, the things I'm really, really enthusiastic about. Oh my goodness. Well, you know, I do think we're in a TV drought for a reason, you know, between private equity, strip mining things, between the writer's strike and between the kind of the tendencies of the stream that I kind of anatomize, I think there's less and less good TV. I did enjoy A Murder at the End of the World very recently. It has Clive Owen. It's a kind of Scandinavian noir, true crime type thing that is, you know, sort of has an Elon Musk bad guy, but sort of has like a surprise other direction of where the force of violence and crime is coming from. And is very beautifully and disturbingly kind of shot in Iceland and has a lot of dystopic environmental dimension to it. I was talking with you, I guess, before we hit record, about some art I saw in Chicago recently. The Cincinnati artist Courtney Cooper, who makes these beautiful large-scale maps of the city he lives in, Cincinnati, that has incredible topography, and they have all these distortions, but also all this realism to them. They are incredibly faithful kind of accounts of real landmarks and real spaces and neighborhoods in the city, as they are also imaginative and you know, distorted, and they're big, and they're just great. So I really enjoyed looking at those recently. And let's see, what did I read recently that I thought was actually quite good? I just read Adele Waldman's novel, Help Wanted. I have galleys of it. It's going to be out really soon, but she had a piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that's a sort of preview of the novel, but it was a nonfiction piece about part-time laborers and in big box stores, and about the use of part-time working conditions or part-time employment to really kind of terrorize people. And the novel is, you know, is like people who work unloading the trucks at like Target. And it's really, it's third person, it's polyphonic. All these characters are all very flawed, and nonetheless, you like them all in interesting ways. And the kind of texture of like using a multi-plotted novel to try to think about teamwork and also conspiracy and maybe like political campaigns or unionization campaigns or solidarity or comradeship, and just the care that people might put out towards one another. It's great. I loved it. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being here, Anna, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much for doing this.